Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, the day after the Vegas fight night. Virtually every pundit in America right now has a hangover, and at the Bulwark, we have no fewer than four hot takes, some of them hotter than others. We have Jonathan Last, Vegas fight night. Jim Swift has his take on this. Bill Kristol asks who won. And then there's me, and I call it the smod debate, the sweet meteor of death. And we needed another take from across the political pond here. So once again, we are joined by Will Salatan from the National Political Correspondent for Slate Magazine. How are you doing?
Great, Charlie. How are you?
You got 3 hours of sleep last night, right?
Yeah, well, you know, what happens in Vegas apparently extends to Bethesda.
Yeah, no, I got to bed relatively early. I turned off. I made some notes to myself, using a couple of F words. By the way, I'm getting an email that we use the F bomb way too much. So, I actually went on iTunes and saw how many of the Bulwark podcasts have explicit ratings. It's pretty impressive, really. Okay, so. My take was basically sweet meteor of death finally arrived. Earth was spared because it was aimed directly at Mike Bloomberg. Should we just start with him? I mean, that was just ghastly. I don't know how you spin it except to, you know, marvel that $60 billion basically doesn't buy you a whole lot of effective debate prep. So what do you think of Bloomberg?
Yeah, welcome to the NBA, Mike. I mean, one of the weird things about Bloomberg is he earned his cred in the media by spending a lot of money building and using the money to build support in polls, which you can do with TV ads when you go with that kind of volume. But there was never any evidence that he was going to perform well when he connected with voters. I mean, I think he said during the debate, look, these people have been at it for 2 years. I've just been at it for 10 weeks. He hasn't even been at it for a day. Okay. This is like his first time standing up and taking difficult questions in a forum like this. So he's a rookie and he looks it. It doesn't mean he can't do better, but I mean, what do people expect for his first time out? He shielded himself. He insulated himself from this kind of exposure. So he performed as well as one might have expected him to.
Yeah, I think that's a fair take, you know, particularly when you think about the fact that he'd been avoiding having to answer tough questions. So he really didn't allow himself to be vetted. I actually like this one tweet somebody put out. Bloomberg is used to stages at Davos or corporate retreats where he has a fawning audience and is pitched softball questions, and afterwards everyone eats rare sushi while pitching bug-eating schemes to solve global this or that. He isn't used to being actually confronted. So I guess there is that 4.5 hours where they pummeled him on the NDAs was just brutal. It wasn't actually 4.5 hours, but it must have felt that way to him. Although, didn't you get sort of the sense that he's looking around at the other guys going, you know what, I'm just going to have to spend an extra $100 million nuking you guys from deep space?
Yeah, there were several moments in this debate which by themselves seemed small, but if you think about them, they have long-term implications and ironic implications. One of them was Elizabeth Warren saying, you know, Bloomberg, he's performing so badly tonight, he's going to have to drop another $100 million to erase it. Well, and he will. So, you know, her what she thought of as a dig is actually his campaign strategy.
So everybody's all over the board here. So I'm down in thinking that this was just not a great night for the Democrats, that the only candidate really at the end of the night who emerged unscathed was Donald Trump. I described it as a murder suicide worthy of an Agatha Christie novel, and it was bizarre considering, you know, Trump's impeachment trial was just last month. He's in the middle of this revenge tour that involves the undermining of the rule of law. Just in the last 48 hours, he issued pardons and commutations to this motley crew of mooks and cronies and crooks, and nobody mentioned any of this. I mean, how's that possible? It was like, you know, maybe I'm too focused on this, but it did feel like the Democratic debate took place in this alternative non-Trump universe. He was barely mentioned.
Yeah, and I have to plead guilty to being part of your truth there. I normally write about whatever depredations are going on in the Trump administration. And for the last couple of weeks, I haven't been able to do it. I've been sort of focused on the fight within the Democratic Party. Now, in my defense and in the defense of my fellow media, the cowards, I don't know what to call us. We, you know, we're not doing the, necessarily the most responsible thing, except that it really does matter, as you guys know, who the Democrats put up against Trump. We're not going to change how awful Trump is by writing about that at the moment. And we
right. Right. Sort of done that. Yeah.
Right. It's so to the extent that the Democrats are sorting out who the alternative is going to be, that is a bigger story in terms of whether we're going to have to put up with Trump for another 4 years. So, yeah, it's true. They didn't focus on that so much. It's also true that the audience.
They barely mentioned him.
You know, the audience of people they're playing to agrees on that. You're not really going to get much of a distinction on that. And Charlie, I have to emphasize what a desperate fight this is at this point between the Democrats. I mean, in New Hampshire, you had, you know, people nearly died and other people came back to life based on a good debate performance or a bad one. And in Nevada, I'm supposed to say Nevada. You can tell I'm not from Nevada. You can tell how desperate it is by like Elizabeth Warren is clearly hoping to rescue her campaign in Nevada the way that Amy Klobuchar did in New Hampshire. And believe me, it's very close. It's really, really close. Elizabeth Warren has a shot at finishing second in Nevada. It could happen for her. And if that happened, or even a really good third, she could raise money like Amy did. She could be back in the game. The whole media narrative about her could change. So what we think of from the outside as small fights among these Democrats could be entirely pivotal in deciding who.
Okay. All right. You probably can't explain this because a lot of it didn't make any sense to me. I mean, it looked like a six-way cluster, you know, with the moderates attacking moderates. You have the geriatrics, you know, sharing, you know, stories about their stents. This is great. Yeah. You had Pete on Amy, Amy on Pete. Liz Warren lashing out at everyone except Bernie, which I thought was an odd choice because doesn't she need to win the progressive lean against Bernie Sanders? But she devoted most of the time attacking Bloomberg, Klobuchar, and Buttigieg. So help me understand that thinking, because okay, the reason that she's been dropping, hasn't it been because Bernie Sanders has won the internal progressive primary?
Yeah. So let me just put forward my theory. You've probably heard it before, but for Bulwark listeners, I want to like explain why it is that Democrats don't go after Bernie Sanders. You're sitting there tearing your hair out saying, why are they not going after Bernie? The answer, I think, pretty simply is there's a bunch of people in this race fighting for their lives. You're fighting for people who are so sort of in your lane or close to it. But you're really fighting for people who can be moved, who can be pulled away from some other candidate. So, for example, Amy correctly identified that Pete's supporters in New Hampshire were weak. They're weakly attached. They like him, but they could go for her or for somebody else. So we're going to go for those people. Bernie's people are super attached. That is the number one problem that everybody has attacking Bernie. If I attack Bernie, am I going to get any people from Bernie? Is it going to help me get any people who aren't for Bernie but who are for one of my competitors? If the answer to both those questions is no, I'm not going to get anybody, then that's not where I'm going to go for my votes. I'm going to the tragedy of the commons. It does result in the moderates killing each other. And that's certainly true of Pete and Amy, who are fighting for exactly the same voters and are probably preventing each one is preventing the other from rising to a level where they could beat Bernie. But that's kind of what's going on.
Okay, so I'm suffering a little bit of PTSD 2016 flashback, because that, of course, was the exact logic that other Republicans used for not attacking Donald Trump until it was too late, right? Because, you know, Donald Trump has this base, and they're locked in here. You don't want to antagonize them. Plus, he's going to, he'll fade at some point. I don't know that they think that Bernie's going to fade, but it is. It gets from the outside. It does look as if we're in this moment where you have most of those people on the stage knowing that a Bernie Sanders nomination would be, I'm going to put this nicely, highly problematic, that this would be this death march between Trump and Bernie Sanders. And yet, even though this would be the moment that they should focus on coalescing to derail him, they instead, as you just described, spend the evening knifing one another with relish. And of course, this is the tragedy of the commons. So let's talk for a moment about this.
Charlie, what you're describing is what would happen at a convention if conventions still mattered. The convention, run by a thing called the party that no longer seems to exist, is a place where the collective, the entity, the institution of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party says, what's good for us as a whole, as the party? And they make a rational decision, you know, Pete, you step aside, Joe, you step aside, we're going with Amy, or something like that, right? And that's not happening because the decision is being made by campaigns at a very early stage. And I cannot emphasize enough how short-term and desperate a lot of the thinking is. These people are fighting for their lives. They are totally not thinking about how I can get together and prevent the worst.
Okay, so let's play this out, because the prospect of an actual convention here in Milwaukee, and I'm talking to you from Wisconsin, seems to be rising. So you're saying that at some point that the party will say, you need to step aside or you need to do this. Who is the party? Will we ever get to the moment where anyone has that kind of influence and clout or prestige to be able to do that? Is Barack Obama going to descend upon Milwaukee and say, come, let us reason together? Or really, are we in kind of a political parties are completely obsolete and the dynamic that you're describing is just the way it is and it's going to continue through the convention?
Yeah, I am sorry that as I'm listening to you, I'm getting more depressed.
I have this effect all the time. I'm sorry.
I think your diagnosis is correct. What I'm remembering as you're talking about this is, as Trump was piling up delegates and winning the Republican nomination, I wrote a piece in Slate that said the Republican Party was a failed state and Donald Trump is its warlord. Now, I've written many wrong things
that
in my life.
Well.
That one turned out to be true, and not only true, but what you just described is it happening all over again in the Democratic Party. The parties, it is possible that Democrats, too, are a failed state. Sanders has succeeded in peeling back the role of the superdelegates, of running on populism. And the problem in the Republican Party has been one of the necessary factors is cowardice at the top, cowardice among leaders. And that certainly happened. Are Democrats, too, cowards? And I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is that if Bernie, and I don't think Bernie is the same as Trump, by the way, a lot of differences, but if Bernie shows up at the convention with a plurality of delegates, certainly with a clear plurality of delegates, I think it's going to be really, really hard for Democrats for the leadership of the party, such as it is, to muster the courage to say no to that. I think they're much more likely to do what Republicans did and say, heck, this is our guy. Hey, it might work out. Who knows? Yeah, he's problematic, but we can get our judges and so forth and just go with it.
No, I'll raise you one on that. I think if Bernie comes to Milwaukee with one more delegate than the number two person, it's going to be really, really hard to deny him that nomination, in part because the Bernie bros would go nuts. They would lose it. And the Democrats just don't want to put up with that kind of a blowback. You just know what the street theater would be, what the floor theater would be. And this is part of this Bernie bro thing. I have so many things I want to touch on. That came up last night when he was asked about the toxic nature of his supporters. And he tried to sort of, you know, brush it off. But there is something distinctive about that. And, you know, I don't mean to keep invoking PTSD, but, you know, a lot of us remember what it was like dealing with the Trumpian trolls, and the Bernie bro trolls feel like they're, well, it feels very familiar. So can you explain that dynamic? Because, I mean, look, everybody's desperate. Everybody's, you know, passionate. But there's something distinctive about that, the Sanderistas.
Right. Now, so my exposure to these people, I'm not getting doxxed by them, but as somebody in the media who has criticized Bernie Sanders, I didn't believe in this phenomenon of the Bernie Bros until you get online, you get in social media, if you have an address that they can go to, they absolutely descend on you. And they are, so let me put it this way. In my view, the worst people in America are at Donald Trump's rallies. The second worst people in America are Bernie Sanders supporters online. They are just terrible human beings. And I don't know of a better way to put it. It's irrespective of their politics. I mean, their twist on it is if the Trumpers love being deplorable or love being deplored, the Sanders supporters, the Bernie Bros, love deploring. They have the piety of the left instead of the sort of pride in defying political correctness of the right. And because they think they are so pious, they are completely blind to how evil they are, to how base, to how vicious they are. Now, this is not all Bernie Sanders supporters. There are very nice Bernie Sanders supporters. But the phenomenon, the number of Bernie Sanders supporters who are loud, active, and terrible people is so large that it pretty much drowns out the nice ones.
Now, Pete Buttigieg sort of tried to imply that, okay, you're not doing this yourself, Bernie, but, you know, leadership is measured by what you call forth. Do you have any theory about why Bernie? You mentioned liberal piety. Well, they're all liberals. So what is it about Bernie Sanders that he has attracted this? And by the way, it's not just these anonymous trolls sitting in the basement. I thought Bloomberg's campaign actually did a public service by putting together a lot of these troll tweets that were put out by members of Bernie Sanders' staff, his senior staff. So this comes right from the campaign.
Right. Okay, that's a fair point. And he does have, by the way, terrible people at the top of his campaign. But it's a different kind of terrible, because if you're running an organization, you have some responsibility. You have to learn to talk to people. So it's slightly different. I think the problem with Bernie that's different from everybody else, in addition to the piety, is that he's leading a movement and he's a revolutionary. And any student of history, which unfortunately, a lot of my young friends on the left are not students of history, knows that revolutions bring the worst out of people. I mean, look, reaction also brings the worst out of a lot of people, and reaction has done terrible things in history. But revolution fills people with a kind of self-righteousness and a kind of hate. I mean, think about the way Bernie talks in debates and speeches.
Stop you there. Listen to you. You sound like Edmund Burke.
No, really.
Will Salatin.
And I would
get in touch with his inner
a moderate progressive, right? Okay. I like the sort of Pete Buttigieg, the thing. I can go with Joe Biden. I can go with Amy Klobuchar. I can go with Mike Bloomberg, although he's a little obtuse. But Bernie and his people are revolutionaries, and they're very much about what they're against. And of course, you noticed last night Elizabeth Warren talking a lot about fighting. I'm going to fight. The word fight was coming back. So this whole idea of the bad guys fighting, attacking, beating them, that gets certain kinds of juices going in people. And whether you are on the left or the right, it makes you hate and it encourages you to hate. And that's part of what drives the Bernie movement.
So it is fair to say that after last night, Bernie Sanders is still in the lead. Do you agree with that?
And
he's poised to do pretty well on Super Tuesday. He's poised to do well in California. So it did occur to me last night that Bloomberg's grand plan to derail Sanders has backfired, because he drew a lot of the fire that should have been aimed at the socialist from Vermont. And Bernie got off relatively unscathed over, you know, the flip-flop on releasing his medical records. I'm going to come back to that. You know, the cost of Medicare for all and all the other baggage that Trump's going to, you know, wrap around his neck in the fall. So it is this dynamic where Democrats have been saying we are focused on electability, and yet they seem to be poised to go with this revolutionary. I mean, they are rolling the dice with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I have to say, though, I don't know on this Earth 2 where Bloomberg isn't in the race, I don't think still that this Nevada debate turns out to be people attacking Bernie Sanders. I think the reasons why people are not attacking Bernie go deeper than that. And Bloomberg is a convenient foil if you're not going to attack Bernie. But if it weren't him, it could easily be somebody else. If Pete had won New Hampshire, it would be Pete. If Amy had won New Hampshire, it would be Amy. It was Biden for a time. I just don't see if you narrowed the number of candidates, then I can see it being worth the while of that remaining moderate candidate to do it. But yeah, I just don't see that. And I agree. I mean, I think Bernie's going to win Nevada. I think Biden has sunk enough in South Carolina that we're looking at Bernie probably taking the first four contests, if you count the raw vote in Iowa as Iowa. And I don't see anybody else. Bernie is guaranteed viability. He's guaranteed delegates in every Super Tuesday state, and nobody else really is.
So, I mean, and if Biden, you know, does come back and win in South Carolina, it might change the narrative somewhat. But I'm trying to think who it was who had the analysis of the way the California primary works. I think it was Ed Rendell. I was listening to so much stuff last night. You know, former DNC chairman from Pennsylvania said that and you correct me if I'm wrong on all of this. There's a ton of delegates in California. It is not winner take all, but you have to hit the 15% viability threshold in each congressional district. So if Bernie Sanders is getting 30% and all of the non-Bernie folks are still in the race and they're all getting 12-13%, he could end up basically running the table and getting the vast majority of California delegates. And that's pretty much game over then. I mean, yeah, that would be the biggest argument for, you know, coming together and somebody's got to drop out, because if you're all in that race and you're not hitting 15%, then you are seriously behind the eight ball.
Right. And I think, you know, Buttigieg said something last night about how, you know, we could wake up on right after Super Tuesday and be left with the Bloomberg and Sanders. And he's not saying that out of, you know, that is a extremely well justified theory of what's going to happen. I want to add one other thing, though, before we get there. And that is that Tom Steyer is doing really, really well in South Carolina. And one thing to keep an eye on is anybody who he could easily finish third. Hell, he could finish second. He could fall, but he's doing really well. He's got a lot of black support. Anybody who finishes below Tom Steyer in South Carolina is going to look terrible, just terrible. And that could end up being everybody but Bernie. It could end up being everybody but or Biden. I mean, everyone's going to look really small. And then we go into Super Tuesday. And that is just a thing to keep an eye on.
So Steyer can be the ultimate spoiler here. That he can wipe out everybody else.
Because there's a lot of people who like to survive by saying they did a good third or a close fourth. It doesn't look that way when you're finishing behind Steyer.
This is a great point. Now, Nicey, you bring up Tom Steyer on the show, on the episode that I promised I wasn't going to use the F word. So I'm sort of speechless now because I want to say so much about Tom Steyer. What is the rationale for his candidacy at the moment, other than I'm another billionaire and I've been running on a middle, like what?
Well, Steyer is going to be like the Democratic billionaire. You just saw Bloomberg attacked as the not really Democratic billionaire. And Steyer actually, you know, I don't know, these guys who don't do anything in politics and then they show up with their money and they can buy ads, they can buy some support in the polls, but ultimately they have to stand on their own. And if they're not good at retail, eventually it tells. I am surprised at how well Steyer is held up in South Carolina. He's not doing badly in Nevada either.
Yeah, no, that's an amazing story. Okay, so I want to talk about Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg. I actually thought for most of the debate they did pretty well. You know, and what I wrote in the Bulwark is, you know, in this alternative universe that we wish you would, you know, that we wished we lived in, the nation would be turning its eyes to these, you know, comparatively youthful Midwestern centrists. The Democrats would say, you know, Pete Buttigieg is the most gifted politician of his generation, which I think he is. You know, they would say that, you know, Amy, this is the answer. This is the most electable candidate in a general election. Instead, we got this mean girls thing. I mean, that was nasty. Pete and Amy really, really don't like each other. And it's not just that they're desperate, you know, in the lanes. I mean, there's real personal animus there. And so,
I actually don't think it's both-sided. I think it's one-sided.
Okay, tell me about it.
This is one of those places where I think personality matters. The older I get, the more experience I have, the more I see personality messing up all these grand theories about how history is going to unfold. So here's the personality thing that's going on. For whatever reason, Amy Klobuchar is a much, much angrier person than I understood at the beginning of the race. I did not work in her Senate office.
No, ditto.
When I read the articles about her treating staff badly, I thought, actually, good for her. She eats her salad with a comb. You know, she's
tough boss.
She's a strong woman. Mm-hmm. That's the way I thought of it. But I have really been struck by how angry she is. And her anger turned on Pete Buttigieg. Now, I can understand why it did, right? She had this lane she was going to run in. She was going to be the moderate Democrat who could do and then this nobody from her point of view, the mayor of South Bend, racks up all this
kid.
He raises all this money. He's okay, he's gay, but he's white, he's male. Okay, I'm white too. But he's a young man who would never be able to get away with this if he were a woman. And she's pretty much said that. And then he has the temerity to run against her Washington experience and hold that against her. And she's sitting there thinking, you've got to be kidding me. I busted my tail. I got into the Senate. I've been working on legislation. I get things done and I get attacked for my experience. So for whatever reason, she has taken an extreme dislike to him. And the result is, unlike other candidates who are able to put that aside, she has dialed in on him and is trying to kill him in ways that don't even make sense for her strategically. She did a really good job in New Hampshire. She took a lot of support from him. She got a strong third. But she dug in this debate in attacking back at him in ways that I don't think were helpful to her, much less to him.
Yeah, this is one of these Rorschach tests, because I'm seeing people online saying that, no, her righteous anger might actually help her. This might catapult her forward. This might be her comeback. My, you know, in real time take was she looked visibly rattled. And it was a little bit, putting your teeth on edge there, because you did have flashes of this anger, and I'm not sure that it was effective. So because I'm extremely online, and this is why I'm usually bad watching debates, because I'm yelling at the screen saying you should say this, you should say that, but you know, she should have known she was going to be asked the question, why didn't you know the name of the president of Mexico? I mean, there's a number of ways of handling it, including being very self-deprecating about it. But this is, and I tweeted this out yesterday, I said, this is what she should have said. And this goes back to my theme about you guys are running into 2020, you're running against Donald Trump, remember? So when she's asked, you know, how come you didn't know the name of the president of Mexico, she could have said something self-deprecatory and then said, let me tell you what I do know about Mexico. They were never going to pay for that effing wall. And that's why Donald Trump is now raiding our military to pay for it. Now, you know, if she would have gone that, you know what? The crowd would have gone absolutely nuts. It would have been one of the sound bites of the night. You know, take it, turn it to something, go after Trump, distinguish yourself in that way. But it didn't happen. So you don't think her flash helped her much?
No, I think what you just described would have been the intelligent way to do it. And as you know, in politics,
I'm available.
These candidates have people around them who tell them, here's what would be the sensible way to handle this. And the problem is your boss, the candidate, has a personality and is incapable, as the entire Trump administration knows this, right? And so she did, you know, that's exactly right. The correct play is laugh it off, talk about, you know, what you do know, and you be above it. That's what you be. I just, you know, I'm surging, I'm rising. That's her message. But she said, I mean, at least twice in that debate, Charlie, she said, referring to Pete, he just made a really serious allegation at me. I need time to respond. Yeah. No, he didn't.
No, he didn't.
He said, you didn't know the name of the president of Mexico.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Are you trying to say that I'm dumb? Are you mocking me here, Pete?
And that was right. And so what came across was insecurity, more than anything else. And, I think that somebody who had Amy Klobuchar's positions, who had her experience and was a little more self-confident, would be able to handle that in a much better way that would be fruitful.
Okay, so let's step back and a couple of things, and this is punditry at its lowest common denominator. I can't tell whether this is really good punditry or bad punditry. I'm going to tell you what I hear people talking about in airports. because I spent a lot of time in airports. Okay, this is the stuff that breaks through. Bernie Sanders' health and Pete Buttigieg's gayness. Okay, so let's start with Bernie Sanders. He didn't really get nailed on this, but this strikes me as a really serious problem for him. Flipping on releasing his medical records. He's a 78-year-old man who had a heart attack, promised he was going to release the medical records, is not releasing the medical records. You do not have to be a rocket scientist to know how that's going to play in the campaign. And this is a very easy to understand issue. And so when I'm listening to people talk, I'm eavesdropping on conversations, they're not talking about Medicare for all or who's got the best infrastructure plan. They're talking about, you know, so Sanders might, I mean, he might have the big one, you know, even before the election. This is a problem. It is a problem, isn't it?
Are these people you're talking to Democrats? Or
I'm not talking to anyone. I'm listening in. Just listening.
Okay, so I am unpersuaded. Let's put it this way. I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical that Bernie's health is going to be as big that big an issue. The reason is I don't see people voting on it. They may gossip about it, but like he's going to, as long as he keeps going with this theory we've just talked about, he's going to rack up delegates. He has his hardcore supporters. He ends up with the nomination. Then we get to a general election. Then is it relevant? Well, now you're running against Donald Trump, who people either love or hate. And so I'm really skeptical that
okay, Bernie, that's a now fair Bernie, point.
If but, Bernie, but, has one more event,
yeah, well, yeah.
Incident that changes everything. Although I thought the first one would change more.
So, I would have thought if it had been Joe Biden, it would have been over right then.
Yeah. So I could be wrong about that. But this issue of transparency, I mean, one of the things that Donald Trump has done for me, Charlie, is he has cured me of the illusion that I used to have that you have to be transparent.
Mm.
He's not, you know, given away his medical records, and Trump is still not in trouble for refusing to give up his tax records. And I think Bernie's going to get away with it.
Well, he has moved the Overton window of jerkitude. There's no question about it. And we just don't know whether those rules apply just to Donald Trump or whether to everybody else. It's a fair point. But of course, going back to Bernie's health, this is how Tulsi Gabbard becomes president of the United States. You know that, right? I mean, when he picks her to be the vice presidential nominee and she's right there, this is how we get President Tulsi.
Okay, so I have to say that one of my favorite pastimes is listening to Republicans and conservatives guess who Democrats would put on the ticket. It's like watching Roger Federer make challenge balls being in or out in tennis. It's just something that they're really bad at.
Yeah.
So Tulsi is.
So help me with this then.
I could be wrong about many. I've been wrong about many things, but I don't know how many laps I'm willing to run around the Washington Beltway, if I'm wrong about this, but Tulsi Gabbard will never get within sniffing distance. Yeah,
I'm just trolling you on all of that. But whoever is picked, people are going to look at that ticket and go, "That's going to be the next president, right there." So, I mean, okay. So let's go back to Pete Buttigieg, and I have to say this was not one of my high points of the last week. This was right after Rush Limbaugh had launched his attack on Pete Buttigieg. And there was a Wisconsin couple. They were headed off to God knows where. And they're talking about this. And they're referring to him as Pete. And how does Limbaugh call it, you know, booty judge or something? They really like the booty judge. And they were talking about, you know, the mayor. Now, these were probably not Democrats. But it was interesting how quickly the homophobia had gone out there, that Rush Limbaugh had, you know, greenlit it. And now he's saying that he talked to Donald Trump about it. And Donald Trump says, whatever you do, Rush, don't apologize for all of that. So here you have, you know, once again, the Overton window moves of acceptable things you can say about gay people. And you know, but by now there's no question. Will the Republican Party go along with that? Of course they will. We're going to see that.
So let me address this in two ways, one about the media and one about the polls. On the media, it is absolutely true. One of the problems with the Pete being gay, with the way it's covered, is that the media doesn't want it to be an issue. Mm-hmm. So they don't deal with it. It isn't even polled as much as it should be polled. Nobody wants to look like they're raising it. it's, you know, it's now considered bigotry in the same way racism is bigotry. And so it gets undercovered and perhaps underappreciated by reporters. I mean, if you go to a dinner party with reporters or you hang out at a social event with reporters, it's just not an issue. So why would it be such an issue with everybody else? Or let's not make it an issue. But so it's underplayed. But I was recently, like within the last week, looking at polling data on this. And unless people are lying to pollsters, which is possible, being gay turns out not to be as big a problem in terms of whether people would consider voting for you or would vote for you as other things. Not as nearly as big as being, it's not a, an atheist or a Muslim or certainly a socialist. Socialism polls much worse. So the other fact, of course, is that it's highly concentrated in people who are going to vote for Trump anyway. So the homophobia factor in the general election, I think is, I mean, I'm guessing it's low, but as I say that, given point number one, Charlie, I have to say I probably underestimate it a little.
Yeah, I think the dynamic you describe is correct. And so I was hoping that by the time we were done doing this podcast that we would get the Roger Stone definitive sentence. I mean, what we're certainly getting now, and we're doing this in real time, is Judge Amy Berman Jackson is signaling she's not going to go easy on Roger Stone. And the Department of Justice is kind of like all over the place trying to explain themselves. I mean, it's really kind of a bizarre picture. But at the end of the day, we know how this play ends, don't we? We know that Donald Trump is going to pardon Roger Stone. He's going to pardon Flynn. He's going to pardon Paul Manafort. Is there any doubt in your mind that that's going to happen?
Some version of that. I don't know the extent of it or exactly how many people, but I'm guessing all three of them. And I have to say, this is why the election is what worries me so much, is because it's the last stop, right? It's we've already established that. There's the Trump administration itself is not going to stop the president, or no one's going to stand in the way. No one's going to fall on their sword over this complete corruption, the whole banana Republicanization of the Republican Party in the United States. The Senate is not going to. So Republican lawmakers are equally cowardly, equally cowed. They're not going to stand in the way. And they're all saying, leave it to the election. And we're now looking at an election where we may not have a Democratic alternative, a Democratic nominee who is capable of taking down Trump or is likely to take down Trump. And so we're left with a world in which this kind of banana republic behavior, I mean, I'm talking about, we are like the worst, you know, Latin American dictatorship when it comes to this betrayal of the rule of law. We're now left with a world in which there will be no accountability for that, none. And I'm sorry to, you know, end up on such a dismal note, but there we are.
Well, I actually, on yesterday's podcast, I had former Deputy Attorney General Donald Aaron. He was more optimistic. He agrees with your analysis that we're headed toward that sort of banana republic system. And he's, you know, calling on Bill Barr to resign, which I don't think is going to happen. Bill Barr is going to stick around. He's not going to be impeached. So the question is, what guardrails still exist? Because I agree with you that if we're getting closer and closer to this naked use of political power, you know, that I am the state and I'm going to protect my friends and I'm going to punish my political enemies and nobody's going to stop me. So you wonder, what are those institutions that will push back? Will the federal judiciary hold the line? I have not completely given up hope on that. What about the professionals in the Department of Justice? And I asked Mr. Ayer, what about the prospect of mass or large scale resignations or other protests? And no one knows. But you know, we have been throwing around terms like constitutional crisis way too lightly for way too long, and I'm afraid we don't recognize that we're coming up to a big one that really doesn't have that many historical parallels.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. You're talking about guardrails, and I like talking about guardrails. I like thinking about them, and I like to believe that we still have checks and balances that capable of stopping this. But I'm sort of, as you're talking, it's making me realize that what's our best friend is actually the incompetence of Trump and the absence of a real movement. I mean, there isn't a coherent movement. This isn't like the Nazi movement or the Bolshevik movement. There, this is one guy and his craziness. And part of the result of that is, let's take judges, for example. I agree with this point about the judiciary. People, my friends on the left talk about Trump judges. There aren't really Trump judges. They're Republican judges. They're Federalist Society judges. Trump is not capable. He is not intellectually capable of filtering judges to choose for complete loyalty to him. So he's put in Republican judges. Well, these judges are not committed to Donald Trump. They're not beholden to him. He just fails. He lacks the ability to exercise the kind of total control over his appointees that would be necessary to prevent them from doing things he doesn't want to do that get in his way. And so I do think some of the guardrails can hold because of the shortcomings of Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, let's leave it on that positive note, because we have to have some, because, you know, quite frankly, in the last week, I've begun thinking about, okay, so how will we handle a second term of Donald Trump? How different would it be than the first term? And those, the questions you're raising, I mean, that goes right to the heart of this, because I think it's naive at this point to expect any elected Republicans to be attacked as guardrails. I mean, that seems like we are way past that. So Will Salatin, national correspondent for Slate, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast and spending so much time with us.
Thank you, Charlie. Among other things, you taught me how to pronounce bulwark.
You know what? This is not my strong suit, believe it or not. Even though the years in radio, I mispronounce things all the time, particularly names.
When you start a word with bull, I always assume it's going to be pronounced bull, because I know your other vernacular. So, yeah.
Well, thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.